I am still continuing with the ninth chapter, which is the chapter dealing with Sat, or the pure existence. We have seen how the pure reason perceives the stable, the stability, the reality which is unmoved. But we saw that from the point of view of the movement which has causal relationship in it, effect and cause, cause itself being an effect and a cause, until we reach a point where we say there must be a ground for the entire movement, and that itself must be uncaused. Now, there is another way of coming to the same conclusion. I am doing this because, even though from one point of view you arrive at this conclusion, it may be argued that the world does not consist merely of causal connection. You remember last time I gave you 14 elements, and the world consists of so many elements, and basically you should come to the same conclusion from the anything that you take up, and you should come to the same conclusion, then only your conclusion is absolutely established. Now, I don't want that we should do all the 14, although it can be done. But at least two or three I should do with you, so that the same principle you can apply afterwards. Even here now, the second example I am taking, the same principle will apply, but it will also give us something more than what we got from the previous one. This time I take the aspect of time. The peculiarity of time is that the moment you look at time, you realize that there is always a before and an after. This is a speciality of the nature of time. And that gives you an idea of some kind of eternity. Eternity in which there is always a before and an after, a continuous which does not end anywhere. This is not the only meaning of eternity. There are many other meanings of eternity also. But this is one meaning of eternity, that which has no end or beginning. That is what we mean by eternal. It is eternity of the time movement, in which there is always before and after. Now, when there is this before and after, we call it succession. So you might say, time is succession of moments. This is a short definition of time that is very often presented. Time is succession of moments. Now, although this definition seems to be true, considering the kind of experience that we have, we speak of the era of time. It moves on and on and on in a movement of succession. Therefore, this definition of succession of moments is true in a certain sense in which we experience normally the time. But when you examine this nature of succession, you will come to some other conclusion, and which I shall now examine. If time were only a succession of moments, then between one moment and the other moment, there must be a breath. Now, what is the nature of that breath? Is it itself time? Or is it not time? If there is a succession of moments, then between one moment and the other, there must be a break. Otherwise, you can't say one moment is finished and the other moment has started. There must be a break. If there is a break, what is the nature of that break? If it is time, if it is time, then again it is succession of moments. Again there must be a break. Again in between the two moments there must be something which is either time or not the time, or not the succession of moments. Now if it goes on like this, then the game can go on infinitely. Anything that you see the time in between can be broken, because it is time is succession of moments. That is the definition we have taken. So if time consists of succession of moments, then this difficulty will come, and therefore it may seem as it were, before you can connect this moment with that moment, there will be infinite moments which can never be finished. If they can never be finished, you can't go from one moment to the other. So it seems that this particular movement, this kind of analysis or this kind of nature of time does not seem to be varied, because the second moment exists. If the second moment did not exist, you can say, alright, one moment is finished and before the second one starts, there is infinity between the two. Eternity between the two, you can go on and on until the second moment comes into being. But that is not true. Second moment does come into existence. Therefore, the intermediate point cannot be time. Time understood in the sense of succession of moments. What then is that? That which is between one moment and the other, what is it? The answer that is given is that it is duration without succession. If there is succession, then the problem arises. So the answer is that in between the two there is duration, but not succession. So now we get a second definition, that time is basically duration, which you can divide in any way you like. Time is duration, which you can divide any way you like, so that you can make succession in any manner you like. You must have seen, for example, that when you are in a very good state of mind, 1 hour passes away in a wink. There are other times when there is so much of boredom that even 1 minute looks like an hour. Now, what is the reality? Is that time which you spend in a wink, was it really a wink? And the moment which is of boredom, in which even 1 minute looks like an hour, was it really an hour? The answer is that basically, time is always duration, which you can make in the form of succession according to what is convenient to you. Now, this is true only of our own ordinary consciousness, that even to our consciousness, time runs faster or slower according to the consciousness that we have regarding what is happening, what is the duration. Whatever duration, it depends on your consciousness, how much is it long or short. Therefore it is said that there are two aspects of time. One is what may be called pure duration. A given moment which is given to you is a pure duration in which you don't distinguish between past, present and future. In a lovely company, 1 hour that you spend is like one moment. The whole 1 hour was one moment in which past, present, future doesn't exist in as far as that time is concerned. So depending upon your state of consciousness, you can divide the duration into before and after according to your state of consciousness. And then there is a real succession of moments. So there is duration on which you mark out your succession according to your state of consciousness. Now this corresponds to the idea of the Vedic Rishis, which says that time is one moment. According to the Vedic Rishis' concept of time, time is one moment. It is we who, according to our convenience, break it into past, present and future. That is why the Rishi has Trikal Drishti. Trikal Drishti means the knowledge of the past, present and future. So, in Trikal Drishti, the three times, past, present, future, are seen as one moment. But they can be divided into past, present, future in any way you like. So, we have now seen two aspects of time. Time as duration, which consists of a moment which in itself has no succession. But on that canvas of duration, you can mark out past, present and future according to your state of consciousness. So time in itself is simply a duration, not a successive duration. It is simply a duration on which you can mark out successions according to what you think, what is convenient to you. If you are writing a history, then 50 years may be regarded as one short period. If you are not writing a history, then 50 years is a very long period. But in history, 50 years is only one short period. So depends upon your convenience, whether it is before or after, depends upon your convenience and your standpoint. So succession of moments, that definition of time, is valid in terms of the standpoint that you take. Wherever you want to stand, you stand there and then look, this way it is before, that it is after. So now we have two definitions of time. Time as succession of moments, which we saw is not entirely valid. Because if it was a real succession in which there was a real division between one moment and the other, then that gap can never be filled up. Therefore, it is only a kind of a convenient definition of time depending upon your standpoint. The other definition of time is it is a duration. But now let us take the idea of time as duration. All duration is extension. This is another definition I am presenting. All duration is extension. Now, extension is a process and it constantly goes on increasing. Extension is a process of expanding. Expanding means that it has a certain kind of a beginning and then it moves forward. Therefore, without a beginning, just as in the case of causality, cause and effect, we have come to the conclusion of a beginning. Here also, if it is extension, it must begin to extend somewhere. Here we are not talking of causal effect, cause and effect relationship. Merely the movement of extension. But even movement of extension has to have beginning. But beginning is such a thing which itself is not extended. Because if it is extended, it must have a beginning. An extension which has a beginning in something which is itself an extension, then that extension must have begun somewhere else. So its beginning must be in something which is itself not extended. Therefore, we can say that time is a succession of moments. Behind which there is a duration, behind which there is something which itself is not extension, and that is what is called timeless. The Vedanta speaks of the timeless reality. So you may say that the grounding of time is in something that is itself timeless. Therefore, the idea of extension does not apply to it. The idea of duration doesn't apply to it. It is a timeless from which the time moves out. But you will immediately see that when I speak these words, there is a discomfort. A timeless from which the time moves out. When does it move out? If you ask the question, when does it move out of the timeless? The answer is impossible, because when is a concept which is applicable only to time movement. When there was no time, in the timelessness there is no time. So how can you say it arose out of it on this date? Because there was no such time at all. The idea of time doesn't belong to that. Therefore it is said that timeless is fundamental. The movement of duration is phenomenal. And it is a result of the convenience of your consciousness. According to the convenience of consciousness, you can measure it, and whenever you measure, there will be always before and after in the movement of succession. So once again, from the rational point of view, you have now three concepts. Time as succession of moments, time as duration, and the grounding of time in which there is timelessness. It is therefore said that time as duration and time as succession of moments is a category of consciousness. How the consciousness looks at the process of extension. And when you look beyond the category of consciousness, time disappears. There is only timelessness. Now it is this timelessness which is also called eternity. So you have three eternities. The eternity which is timeless, the eternity which is a duration, which in itself is not successive, and eternity which is successive. And all the three can coexist. It is not as if once a time becomes duration, timeless ceases. That timeless remains. It is thano, it is stable. The duration does not rule out the possibility of cutting it into successive movements. So all the three can coexist. Such is the concept at which we arrive at through reasoning. But it is also the concept which you arrive at when we have the supreme experience. It is not only that by reasoning we arrive at this concept, but also when we go into deep experience of God, of reality, you find it has all the three statements about it. It is beyond what is called space and time. It is eternal time, in the sense of eternal duration, which corresponds to the Trikal Drishti of the Rishi. And there is the eternity of successive movement of time. So there are three ways in which you look at reality. Timeless reality, timeless duration, and timeless movement of succession. So both from the point of pure reason and from the point of experience, you arrive at this conclusion that reality is timeless in the sense of beyond all time movement. It is time eternity in the sense of a duration, and it is time eternity in the sense of successive movement or moments. Now let us concentrate once again on the timeless eternity, the first term, which is called Brahman in the Vedanta. The Brahman is timeless, there is no application of time on it. It is a ground of time, but it is not itself connected with time. It is, you can't even say it is always the same. Because the moment as it is always the same, time is already applied to it. It has no extension because extension moves out of it, so it is not extended. So unextended, that to which no concept of time can apply, that is the meaning of pure existence. Pure existence is that to which no extension of any kind of time movement can be applied. That is the definition of the pure existence. But then what happens to the extension? If it comes out of it, somehow it must be in it. Otherwise, how can it come out of it? Therefore, it is said that it is that kind of existence such that all extension can enter into it, just as if you have toys of clay, you break them, they all go back into formless clay. Similarly, all duration, all succession of moments enter into it, they cease to be duration and succession of moments, but from where again you can build up, just as out of the same clay, again you can make any form that you like. The only magic in the world or in reality is this, that there is a reality such that being formless, it can give rise to forms. And these forms, when they go back, they cease to be forms and they become formless. This is the example that is given in the Upanishad. The gold remains gold, even if you make lot of ornaments out of it. Ornaments are called to be name and forms. And when you break them, they again go back into the original, which has no form itself. Such is the relationship between the formless and the form. But whenever there is a process of all processes of formation implies a movement of energy. Now, if there is movement of energy, even that movement of energy must be coming from, and that pure existence which is stable, which you have seen also both from the point of causality and from the point of time, and the same conclusion we can arrive by any other example you take of quantity or modality or anything, or even from the point of space, we always come back to this ground which is stable and which is above all the quantity, all the quality, all the forms of all space, all time. And it is a ground from where all that we call time and space and quantity and quality and relation and modality, all of them arise. Now here, there are two important statements that we made. That this ground which is stable must be one and indivisible. This is a further proposition that we have to show, that this reality, this table, is one and not many. It is one and indivisible. Now let us first apply our reasoning and then let us go through the experience. How do we show that the stable ground of these multifarious movements is only one? And then it is indivisible. This is the conclusion to which you arrive when you try to look at it from the point of the reason. Supposing there were two, then there must be a relationship between the two. Because both of them exist. As far as existence is concerned, they must be united. Therefore, if there are two, they must be related. The moment there is relationship, it can be either relationship of succession or a relationship of cause and effect. And cause and effect relationship can only end when there is one ground for it. So even if there are two, we arrive at a conclusion that they must be all ultimately going back into oneness. Now it must be indivisible, because if they are divided, if anything is really divided, then they become two. But these two, if they exist, they again they agree into one common element of existence. Again there are relationship between the two. And the relationship can ultimately be explained only when you go back to the one ground reality. So reality must be one and indivisible. Now in experience, the Vedanta explains, or it states, actually its affirmation is, that ekam eva advitiyam. The reality is one without the second. This is in experience also to be found, that reality is one without the second. It is also avivaktam. The Bhagavad Gita says that it is avivaktam. Although it may appear vivaktam, although it appears divided, in the consciousness of time succession and of duration, there may be a sense of vivaktam.
But in itself it is avivaktam, it is indivisible. So even from the point of your experience, reality is found to be one and indivisible. Now if reality is one and indivisible, then a further consequence follows. That movement of energy must be also in that reality, there being only one reality. Therefore, if movement of energy is there, it must be also in there, it can't come from elsewhere. There are no two elsewheres. If there are only, if there are two realities, you can say that movement of energy comes from one source and stability is another source or another reality. But if there is only one reality, and if there is movement of energy, it must be coming from that stable reality. That is why we have the concept of Shiva and Kali. Shiva is stable, Kali is the movement. But Shiva and Kali are one. Kali doesn't come out from somewhere else. Kali's root is in Shiva. Having answered this question, now the second question is Shiva obliged by Kali to be in constant motion? Or is Kali under the control of Shiva, so that whenever Shiva says stop, Kali would stop? What is the relationship between the two? Both are one. But movement of energy, which moves out, is it under the control of Shiva or is it not under the control of Shiva? Now this question can be answered only if we know whether this movement is unconscious or conscious. It is only consciousness which can determine control whenever you want control, and no control whenever you do not want control. If it is purely mechanical and if it is always in movement, it is not controllable. It is only if there is a consciousness that energy can obey the will of Shiva. If it is simply unconscious, then to expect obedience from Shiva, from the ground reality, is impossible.
That is how Shiva put feet on the Kali.
That's right.
When she was.
That's right.
That's the.
That is the real meaning of
so
it.
So that what cannot be.
That's right. Yes. So it is under the control of Shiva.
Yeah.
Now, whether the energy is ultimately conscious or not is now the central question to which we have arrived. And that is the subject matter of chapter number 10. Is energy, is force, conscious or unconscious? That is why the chapter number 10 is entitled Conscious Force, where Sri Aurobindo will show how rationally we find that force is consciousness, and also how experientially we find that force is consciousness. Both from the point of the reason and from the point of experience, you come to the same conclusion. Now, I have summarized before you the entirety of chapter number 9. Now, there are two alternatives. Either we read together here the entire chapter number 9, or you will read at home according to your convenience, in which case we can proceed to chapter number 10 right now, or we can hold here and we can read the entire chapter number 9 rather rapidly so that you become familiar with what are the contents of chapter number 9. And you will see in what way the summary that I have presented to you makes that chapter now much more easy to follow. I will read paragraph by paragraph I will halt after every paragraph. If anybody wants to put a question, one will be free. But if there is no question, I will proceed to the next paragraph. If you want to stop this.
No, we would like to have it on.
Page number 71. Is it all right? At the very beginning, Sri Aurobindo cites from Chandogya Upanishad, one indivisible, that is pure existence. This is the revelation, this is the from experience. Now, in this chapter, there are three main steps. One is the description of movement of energy that we see all around. Second step is to show that this energy, this movement is subordinate to the stability. And third is the statement that the energy and existence are one, and yet there is a relationship between the existence and the energy. And that relationship will be dependent upon whether the energy is conscious or not. And whether it is conscious or not is then left to the next chapter, that question. These are the three major steps in the whole statement of this chapter. Now, even in the description, in the first part, in the description, you will find that there are three steps. That is, in the first step, there are three steps. First, a description of what we find when we come out of our egoistic preoccupation and look at the whole myriads of universes in the world. What is the impression that we get? Second is a description when we are egoistically preoccupied. And thirdly, once again, when we are not so egoistically preoccupied, in which we get a balance between our own position in that vastness. These are three steps in this description. So let us read. Huh? When we withdraw our gaze from its egoistic preoccupation with limited and fleeting interests, and look upon the world with dispassionate and curious eyes that search only for the truth, our first result is the perception of a boundless energy of infinite existence, infinite movement, infinite activity, pouring itself out in limitless space, in eternal time. An existence that surpasses infinitely our ego, or any collectivity of egos, in whose balance the grandiose products of eons are but the dust of a moment, and in whose incalculable sum numberless myriads count only as a petty swarm. We instinctively act and feel and weave our life thoughts as if this stupendous world movement were at work around us as center and for our benefit, for our help or harm, or as if the justification of our egoistic cravings, emotions, ideas, standards were its proper business, even as they are our own chief concern. When we begin to see, we perceive that it exists for itself, not for us, has its own gigantic aims, its own complex and boundless idea, its own vast desire or delight that it seeks to fulfill, its own immense and formidable standards which looked down as if with an indulgent and ironic smile at the prettiness of ours. And yet, let us not swing over to the other extreme and form too positive an idea of our own insignificance. That too would be an act of ignorance and the shutting of our eyes to the great facts of the universe. For this boundless movement does not regard us as unimportant to it. Science reveals to us how minute is the care, how cunning the device, how intense the absorption it bestows upon the smallest of its works, even as on the largest. This mighty energy is an equal and impartial mother, Samam Brahma, in the great term of the Gita, and its intensity and force of movement is the same in the formation and upholding of a system of suns and the organization of the life of an anthill. It is the illusion of size, of quantity, that induces us to look on the one as great, the other as petty. If we look on the contrary, not as mass of quantity, but force of quality, we shall say that the ant is greater than the solar system it inhabits, and man greater than all inanimate nature put together. But this again is illusion of quality. When we go behind and examine only the intensity of the movement, of which quality and quantity are aspects, we realize that this Brahman dwells equally in all existences, equally partaken of by all in its being. We are tempted to say, equally distributed to all in its energy. But this too is an illusion of quantity. Brahman dwells in all, indivisible, yet as if divided and distributed. If you look again with an observing perception, not dominated by intellectual concepts, but informed by intuition and culminating in knowledge by identity, we shall see that the consciousness of this infinite energy is other than our mental consciousness, that it is indivisible and gives not an equal part of itself, but its whole self at one and the same time to the solar system and to the anthill. To Brahman there are no wholes and parts, but each thing is all itself and benefits by the whole of Brahman. Quality and quantity differ. The self is equal. The form and manner and result of the force of action very infinitely, but the eternal, primal, infinite energy is the same in all. The force of strength that goes to make the strong man is no whit greater than the force of weakness that goes to make the weak. The energy spent is as great in repression as in expression, in negation as in affirmation, in silence as in sound. Clear so far? Yes?
Here, if you can bring a little bit of that, because it is very vipassana.
Yes, that's right. As I told you, when we were discussing the question of time, we say first of all that time appears to us to be succession of moments. Succession of moments implies before and after. All succession means that there was one moment which was before and the other moment which was after. Therefore, there is a division between the before and the after. So it succession of moments seems to us to be a movement of division. Then we saw that behind it there is duration, which is not in itself divided. A duration is not something which is itself divided, because it includes both present, past and future, all of the three movements. But it is capable of being divided according to convenience of our consciousness. Now when we say it is convenient to our consciousness, it means it is not really divided. It depends on the convenience. So therefore, although it is in itself undivided, it is capable of being divided according to our convenience. And even when you divide, it is not really divided. When I say this happened before and this happened after, it is your convenience of consciousness. As I told you, if you take a historical view, then this lecture which is going on is in one continuous present. If you take 50 years to be one division of time, then all that happens in 50 years is one moment, is all present. Therefore, in itself the time is not divided. According to convenience it is distributed. And then we went even beyond the duration and we said there is a reality which is beyond time. Now there the question of division does not arise at all. Now that which is not at all capable of being divided is the real reality. It is the ground of all this. Therefore it is indivisible in itself, which creates a ground of duration which you can divide according to your convenience, but therefore it is not divided in itself. It appears to be distributed but not divided. Is that clear?
That means there is really speaking no past, present and future. If one can go back into the past by way of consciousness, by one's consciousness one remembers the past. So that means the past at least exists so far as the consciousness is there.
You are right.
So that means it is still there.
Absolutely.
It is not past.
Absolutely. It is one moment.
It is one moment.
In that perception, there is a perception in which what you call past is not past there.
Because one is capable of going into that by way of one's consciousness. So it is no past.
That's right. It is there present. Absolutely it is present. Absolutely it is true. That is what Rishi's consciousness says. Nothing is lost. There was a very interesting statement of the mother. Yes, absolutely. They can go back.
Yeah.
Partial. So
they're all there in this, and they also say that the walls and all is still in the realm, and the Rishis can make them like come down also with their ways.
These powers of consciousness are infinite, and you can even relive the past. You can even change the past, which has already occurred. if time is ever present moment.
If some bad has.
That also, that might say.
In that consciousness. In that consciousness. Duration.
That's right. Effect also can be changed. You are right, absolutely. Certain things can be completely eliminated.
That's right.
It can be dissolved. So in any case, then the time looks, from this point of view, to be an ever new moment. An expression which Sri Aurobindo will use in this very chapter is an ever new moment. A duration which is an ever new moment. So that's an expression which will come to later on.
Also, strength and also being the strong man,
these trees over the course of the year, like this, two meals a week, then the distance is as great in position as in expression. And Mr. G told us that the key idea, the master action, and simply there, we bring it from negation to affirmation.
That's true. Therefore, the first reckoning we have to mend is that between this infinite movement, the energy of existence which is the world and ourselves. At present we keep a false account. We are infinitely important to the all, but to us, the all is negligible. We alone are important to ourselves. This is a sign of the original ignorance, which is the root of the ego. That it can only think with itself as center, as if it were the all, and of that which is not itself, accepts only so much as it is mentally disposed to acknowledge, or as it is forced to recognize by the shocks of its environment. Even when it begins to philosophize, does it not assert that the world only exists in and by its consciousness? Its own state of consciousness or mental standards are to it the test of reality. All outside its orbit or view tends to become false or non-existent. The mental self-sufficiency of man creates a system of false accountantship which prevents us from drawing the right and full value from life. There is a sense in which these pretensions of the human mind and ego repose on a truth. But this truth only emerges when the mind has learned its ignorance and the ego has submitted to the all and lost in it its separate self-assertion. To recognize that we, or rather the results and appearances we call ourselves, are only a partial movement of this infinite movement, and that it is that infinite which we have to know, to be consciously and to fulfill faithfully, is the commencement of true living. To recognize that in our true selves, we are one with the total movement, and not minor or subordinate, is the other side of the account. And its expression in the manner of our being, thought, emotion and action is necessary to the culmination of a true or divine living. But to settle the account, we have to know what is this all. This infinite and omnipotent energy. From here we come to a fresh complication. For it is asserted to us by the pure reason, and it seems to be asserted to us by Vedanta, that as we are subordinates and an aspect of this movement, so the movement is subordinate an aspect of something other than itself, of a great, timeless, spaceless stability, sthanam, which is immutable, inexhaustible, and unexpended, not acting, though containing all this action, not energy, but pure existence. Those who see only this world energy can declare indeed that there is no such thing. Our idea of an eternal stability and immutable pure existence is a fiction of our intellectual conceptions starting from a false idea of the stable. For there is nothing that is stable. All is movement, and our conception of the stable is only an artifice of our mental consciousness by which we secure a standpoint for dealing practically with the movement. It is easy to show that this is true in the movement itself.
There is nothing there that is stable. All that appears to be stationary is only a block of movement, a formulation of energy at work, which so affects our consciousness that it seems to be still, somewhat as the earth seems to us to be still, somewhat as a train in which we are traveling seems to be still in the midst of a rushing landscape. But is it equally true that underlying this movement, supporting it, there is nothing that is moveless and immutable? Is it true that existence consists only in the action of energy? Or is it not rather that energy is an output of existence? We see at once that if such an existence is, it must be like the energy infinite. Neither reason, nor experience, nor intuition, nor imagination bears witness to us of the possibility of a final terminus. All end and beginning presuppose something beyond the end or beginning. An absolute end, an absolute beginning, is not only a contradiction in terms, but a contradiction of the essence of things, a violence, a fiction. Infinity imposes itself upon the appearances of the finite by its ineffugable self-existence. But this is infinity with regard to time and space. An eternal duration, interminable extension. The pure reason goes farther, and looking in its own colorless and austere light at time and space, points out that these two are categories of our consciousness, conditions under which we arrange our perception of phenomenon. When you look at existence in itself, time and space disappear. If there is any extension, it is not special, but a psychological extension. If there is any duration, it is not a temporal, but a psychological duration. And it is then easy to see that this extension and duration are only symbols which represent to the mind something not translatable into intellectual terms, an eternity which seems to us the same all-containing, ever-new moment, an infinity which seems to us the same all-containing, all-pervading point without magnitude. And this conflict of terms, so violent, yet accurately expressive of something we do perceive, shows that mind and speech have passed beyond their natural limits and are striving to express a reality in which their own conventions and necessary oppositions disappear into an ineffable identity. Is it all right? This is one of the most difficult paragraphs in the life journey.
Right. Exemplary way, little example.
Then what does it mean when it says which represent to the mind something not translatable into intellectual terms?
What is an intellectual translation of anything? You must have experienced some dreams which last only for a second. But when you describe, it takes 5-10 minutes. Sometimes even one experience which occurs only within a short time. But when you describe it, it takes quite a lot of time. As if there are so many things which happen in one split second, as it were. Now if you say something that happened in a split second happened in 5 minutes,
This is what you are obliged to say. Something that happened in a split second happened in 5 minutes. Now, is it intellectually feasible? And yet it does happen. Now, these are the experiences where you find that in intellectual terms it is untranslatable. Because the moment you translate it becomes contradiction. An event of a split second took 5 minutes to happen. So many things happen in one split second. But normally in our intellectual terms it should have taken 5 minutes or 10 minutes or even 1 hour. But in that state of consciousness it takes place only in a split second. Now such is the relationship between duration of time and succession of time. And the relationship of succession of time and duration of time with the timeless. When you say the timeless gives rise to duration, I raise this question, at what time does it arise? From timeless arises time. At what time does it arise? In timeless there is no time. And if it arises in time, if it arises in time, the time itself arises now, at what moment it arises? If you ask this question and try to find an answer, you will say, it must be happening, but it cannot happen in time. Before the time arises, there is no time. The question when arises is true only of time, which was not yet born. Therefore, the question when does time arise, that question when does it arise, has that question any meaning? It has a meaning, and yet it has no meaning. You will see at once that it has no meaning because the time itself did not exist at that time. Therefore, the question when does not arise. Yet, it has a beginning in that timelessness. It must therefore arise at a certain time. Now that which arises and which cannot arise, with both of them you have to say, is contradiction in terms, untranslatable into intellectual terms.
So in other words, can we say that time arises when we try to intellectualize an event?
Therefore you can say that time is a kind of a duration. It is such an eternal duration which does not at all arise any time, but which has its origin, again I am using the term origin which has a time meaning, but here there is no time meaning. You have to imagine that when I use the word origin, it has no meaning of time, which has an origin in the timeless. So you might say, a timeless eternity, which we call duration, a timeless duration, arises from timelessness, which has no relationship with time. Now, I am obliged to make all these statements necessarily, and you can see immediately that you have got to make this kind of a statement and try to understand that although there are intellectually contradictory statements, this is exactly what we see. And intellectually you can't even write. The moment you write, you fall into contradiction. But such is the original truth of the reality, and which you are obliged to posit. That is why it is said the reality is ashcharya. It is a wonder. Reality is such that it is really adbhutam. It is truly wonderful. Take a simple example of clay and the forms of the clay. This is one of the easiest examples that is given by Vedanta. You take clay and the forms of the clay. Now when the forms are broken, can you find any form in that clay? But they must all be there, because they can come out of it. Now they must be there means there must be eternal there. And yet they are not there. Even when they come out or they do not come out, they are there still. Anytime they can come out, you can anytime make any form. So they are eternally present, eternally not present. So when you try to describe one state of consciousness into another, you fall into contradiction. Therefore, what is advised is that you try to see, don't try to describe. Therefore, it is called indefinable. The moment you try to describe it, you will fall into intellectual terms which are untranslatable. So, it is advised that you try to see what is being said and don't look at the intellectual terms which you are using. Because the moment you use that intellectual terms, you try to hang on them and then try to see if this is so, then this is not so. If this is so, then that is not so. But really speaking, all the three coexist. The timeless, to which time has no reference. Timeless duration in which present, past and future all are obliterated. It is one single moment, one ever new moment, all containing ever new moment. And there is a succession of moments. All the three coexist. It depends now upon the consciousness in which you want to see. It is reality is of such a nature that this is so.
And this is also, this can also be
said non-dual. Precisely. It is only your consciousness which goes on playing with division. But it is not really divided.
Substance
is the same.
Play is the best example, like.
Pardon?
Play or both?
Yes, absolutely the best. That is why the Vedanta Upanishad has given that very example.
That is the best one.
That's why. It's the best example. The ether is another example which the Vedanta has given. These are the most approximate.
Very approximate.
Even that is not accurate because even clay, whatever clay you have, has some form immediately before you.
Can you explain us the example of ether?
Ether is supposed to be, you take a pot, there is ether inside, there is outside, everywhere, all equal. Yes, he also gives that example, quite true. Anyway, this is a paragraph which you need to read
again
10 times, 15 times, 20 times. If you don't understand, don't worry about it, because Sri Aurobindo himself says, intellectually untranslatable. But something that you accurately see. It doesn't mean therefore it's all confusion, not at all. Because sometimes we tend to feel that if it is intellectually untranslatable, that is a confusion. Not at all. The first Sri Aurobindo says, which we intellectually accurately see. It's a perception which is accurate. But when you try to describe it, the words that we use, we are obliged to use those words because there is no other language. If you could invent a language in which the timeless eternity, timeless duration and succession of timeless movements are all described together, if such a language exists, then you can describe it. Otherwise, the moment you describe it our present language, you fall into contradiction. But which we accurately see. The pure reason must really see that there must be behind succession of moments a duration. And behind the duration there must be a reality which is timeless. That's why in my talk I first of all established this point. that succession of moments must have behind them a duration, in which present, past and future are one. And behind the duration there must be a timeless, which itself is not extended. Duration is extension. It must have come out of something. That is the real reality, the pure existence, which itself is not extended, but capable of extension. Without being extension, it is capable of extension. Now, intellectually, it seems to be self-contradictory. That which is not itself extension, capable of extension, and even with extension, it is not extended. Even when extended, it remains still unextended. Such is the nature of reality.
And if this tuning of time is understood well, then the bhaya of...
Yes, of course, certainly. You have also, quite true. You are right, absolutely. That's why you should live in that state of all the three times, we might say. Succession of moments, duration in which there is no succession, and the timeless in which there is no reference to time. Yes, very important. What is time is very important.
In fact, this is the essence.
This is the essence. Very true.